Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello, and thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'm going to put some context around the numbers, perspective around the politics, some clarity around the choices facing us in South Africa. A warm welcome. I'm Jeremy Mags. Coming up on our program today, the Democratic Alliance's Burke U-turn puts political conflicts of interest under the microscope. We'll give you an ethical perspective. South Africa won't run out of water, government is insisting, but that doesn't mean there'll be water coming out of your tap. I'll be talking to the Deputy Water Minister. Food inflation tumbles to its lowest level in 16 years, and Cape Town's new pitch to investors to help turn public property into affordable homes. It's Thursday, the 20th of August. The Democratic Alliance has done an about-turn over its finance spokesperson, Mark Burke, removing him from parliamentary finance oversight roles while the Reserve Bank investigates the fintech company Castello, which Burke founded and in which he remains a beneficiary. Now, as I understand it, Burke says he left the business to pursue politics and has recused himself from Reserve Bank matters. And importantly, there has been no finding of wrongdoing against him. But the DA says he is stepping aside to avoid even the perception of any conflict of interest. So where exactly is the ethical line? I want to talk to Chris Dobie now from the Ethics Institute, and he specializes in this particular field. Chris, a very warm welcome to you. Maybe let's start with a basic test, if we can. What actually constitutes a conflict of interest?
So a conflict of interest we define as when someone's personal interests or outside interests are in conflict with their professional responsibilities. So generally, there's a few tests that that you can do. The first is, can you objectively apply your mind to what is in front of you? Are you acting in the best interest of the professional role that you are asked, and are you transparent in any conflict that comes up? So, where to draw the line is really a tough question, and it really is a case-by-case basis. Whenever we develop conflict of interest policies for organizations, people want a hard and fast line, but unfortunately that doesn't exist. In this case, I can definitely see that there is a potential for a conflict of interest. If not an actual conflict, then at least a perceived conflict, which also breaks down trust.
And that, I think, is a key question. There doesn't necessarily have to be actual wrongdoing, but I think you're suggesting that the perception of a conflict could be enough.
Absolutely. I always use the example where, let's say, a minister's son was involved or received a tender from the department that the minister is in. The minister was not involved in that process at all, but there's no way that you're going to convince the public that that's not the case. So a perception really is very important. In this case, I was glad to see that he had already recused himself from matters relating to the South African Reserve Bank. So one could potentially say that he doesn't have discretionary decision making over any Reserve Bank matters already. So potentially he doesn't need to step aside. But I think, you know, things become so intertwined at the level of parliamentary oversight, and Parliament is also a legislature. So if matters come up in terms of legislation that could influence the matters that he deals with, there's also issues related to that. So I think it's definitely the right thing to do to step down. If he hadn't stepped down or been removed, There would definitely be questions.
But Chris, on a broader canvas, can you realistically oversee a financial system while having a financial interest in a company being investigated by one of the institutions that you oversee?
No, and I think the broader question is almost whether people who are involved in such businesses should be on parliamentary committees that relate to that at all. But yeah, the line there becomes very thin, and to an extent one also wants people who have knowledge of financial systems but who don't have a conflict of interest, and that becomes very difficult sometimes. And sometimes you have to actually deal or live with certain conflicts, not in this case, but you have to live with certain conflicts in order to gain the type of expertise that you are requiring on a committee.
And Chris, the DA initially defended Burke on the basis that there had been no finding of wrongdoing, and then a day later removed him from the finance committee and the broader finance cluster. What does that reversal tell you?
I think we tend to personally know people and think that everything is okay and, you know, this guy is a good person type of thing. But the public perception is very different. It's also a very political space. You know, I also read what other parties had said about this, and it's difficult to draw the line between what is politics and what is actual legitimate criticism. But I think it would have been a mistake from the DA, from a governance perspective, to let it slide, most definitely. I think once someone is under investigation, that is sufficient. The, you know, simple allegations can be weaponized, and people then start having to withdraw from public office or from their duties, and, you know, it can just be abused completely.
Interestingly, the DA says the move is about avoiding the perception of a conflict. So I guess the cynic in me would say, is that good ethical governance or simply crisis management after the fact?
Yeah, I don't know whether the new information came to light for them, but it seems to be that there was crisis management and reputation management rather than governance considerations that came in.
Which does raise the point, surely, that the conflict maybe should have been identified and managed earlier before it became a public controversy.
So, I mean, and that's where I'm saying it was positive for me to see that he had already, of his own accord, noted that there is a potential conflict with Reserve Bank matters. And he had recused himself from any decisions or any deliberations related to Reserve Bank matters. So one could say that that resolved the conflict, but it definitely doesn't resolve the perception of a conflict.
I'm going to leave it there. Chris Dobie, thank you very much indeed. You're from the Ethics Institute. I appreciate the time and the insight. The headlines tell you what's happening, but do you know what it means for your money? Join MoneyWeb editor Rake van Niekerk in conversation with National Treasury Director General Dr. Duncan Pieterse and Gina Skuman, head of Citi Research South Africa, as they explain the economic forces shaping South Africa's future and your financial future. Tuesday, the 1st of September at the Sandton Convention Centre. Register for free using the promo code MoneyWeb. MoneyWeb Summit in partnership with MoneyWeb, the conversations that move markets and your money.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
South Africa is not about to run out of water, says government, but that doesn't necessarily mean water is going to come out of your tap. The Deputy Water and Sanitation Minister, David Mahlobo, says the country has enough resources to avoid a national crisis, but he has acknowledged that aging infrastructure, pollution, failing municipalities are causing increasingly serious local shortages. Government says more than 156 billion rand is being directed towards water and sanitation over the next 3 years. Deputy Minister, a very warm welcome to you. So if the country isn't running out of water, why are so many South Africans angry that there is no water running out of their taps?
Well, we are absolutely correct, Jeremy, in terms of your introduction. When it comes to what we call it water security, which is the availability for the water in our country in terms of our system, we remain a water secure country. with localized deficit, but let's say we're to do a number of interventions because the population has grown, the economy needs more water. Let's say your Clan Williams Dam is upgraded, Lesotho, Zanini Dam, they're all coming on stream at the right time. The crisis, like we are saying right now, is about water and sanitation supply and reliability. The numbers are not lying. South Africans, they do have a tap. The tap is running dry. In certain communities, they've never had water for the last 32 years. Hence, the leadership by President to prioritize the matter where he leads himself. Now we've produced the National Action Plan to address this question of reliability and sustainability of supply. Hence, one of our approaches is to deal with unserved communities where we look at alternative sources of supply. We've done one program here in Hammanskraal, 27 projects opened by President in the Eastern Cape, and then in KwaZulu-Natal, DP and myself. That's our main focus right now. But the water that you can see being leaking everywhere in Johannesburg, Ethekwini, everywhere, that is our main concern. That's why the President has said, let's deploy our technical capabilities in water boards to support these municipalities that are struggling. They have a water leak that they stay for 48 hours, 72 hours, they don't attend to it. Therefore, we're making these entities available to them, deploying technical capacity. But at the very same time, the damage has been allowed to be there for quite some time. It runs to billions and billions of rands to fix this old infrastructure. We have to mobilize funding from private sector, as an example, in terms of performance-based contracts, which is not a new thing. Mbombela has one. You have yard concession of Lulumanzi, KwaZulu-Natal, Ilembe, in Palito. We have a very proper system that is there. And people who are trying to make it as if they were agentizing.
Right.
Those are some of the things that we need to deal with. But more important, we must also pay the issues of the water board so that they can give money. But municipalities must make right decisions. Bring fence money for this water and electricity. Take it back so that you can be able to recapitalize the infrastructure, pay your creditors, and build more assets.
Deputy Minister, you talk about the importance of private sector involvement in this. More than 156 billion rand has been committed over the next 3 years. But how do you stop that money disappearing into badly managed municipalities? Because if that happens, the private sector is simply not going to be interested.
I know private sector will want to do de-risking. One of the most important issues is the reforms that the President has introduced since 2018. Run this thing like a local business enterprise, like a trading servicing. In other words, there must be a good governance, there must be treasury function, there must be the technical know-how and the systems. That's why many of these municipalities, in terms of the incentive out of the billions of rands we're putting aside, there's an incentive of 54 billion, we're starting with the metros. Johannesburg has started to do one. But if you don't reinvest this money from water sales, from these grants, and become transparent on how we are using it, then you are going to have a problem around private sector coming on board. Ring fencing is not an option. It's the best way of managing assets when you sweat it. But then there are municipalities that are small. They don't have the capacity and the assets. That's why you do a model like an SPV, where you bring in a state-owned company like Randwater. Then you create a new entity where there's going to be a shareholding of the municipality, because the municipality must still have a sense of shareholding. Where you have a biggest dark hole, therefore these business people are not going to invest their money when they know that there is no proper governance structure that is there. And then even when we go to the market and look for the blended finance, those are the mechanisms to say, let's have a new delivery model that will actually make it much better in terms of the economics mix policy, where the state and private sector, they are working in tandem to resolve the problem. Because if we don't resolve the water problem, investors are not going to invest. When they don't invest, the economy is not going to grow, and this stubbornness of unemployment is going to persist. That's why we need to look at these various models.
Deputy Minister, you say just over 91% of people have access to water. But the real question surely is how many actually have a reliable daily supply? You've used that word reliable on three occasions in this conversation. Surely government's access figures are simply making the situation look better than it really is. That's not the lived reality of many South Africans.
We are absolutely correct. The access to our water infrastructure is now at 91.3%. Then we have about the 8.7% that we must roll out to that infrastructure. But the reliability is a factor that is of governance, is a factor of infrastructure, is a factor around financing. That's why when you look at the National Water Action Plan, it look at the financing, it look at the issues of technical and operational efficiency of the systems. That's why an intervention like Durban, working with the Umgeni Water, is targeted to reduce the national revenue. Imagine in a metro like a Thekwini that was hovering at 62% loss of water, either illegal connection, cutting, and the pipe burst that are here. When do we have reduced that? Because the intervention works. Johannesburg and Gauteng in particular, you know, Jeremy, one of the biggest problems, we give them about 5.2 billion liters a day, and about 2.4 goes into waste in terms of illegal connection, the pipes that are bursting. Mm. That's why pipe replacement is the biggest catalyst that can change the situation to improve reliability. After we have replaced all these old pipes in Johannesburg, in Pretoria, Ekurhuleni, that is running at above 7 years old and the technology is asbestos, then you can be able to improve the reliability, because the reliability in one municipality here in Gauteng is actually down to below 30%, because the non-revenue water is hovering at 72%. That's why we had to deploy rainwater to try to reverse that particular decay. Mm.
Deputy Minister, just one last question, and maybe on a broader canvas. The Lesotho Highlands project is only 57% complete. Are we not cutting our water security margins too fine while we wait?
I'm happy that as part of the decision President made, that Comrade Pemi, myself, we must unblock all these projects. Remember, Lesotho has been delayed, Jeremy, for more than 10 years. For the first time, it's back on track. We've improved on oversight. The additional water that we'll get from Lesotho is close to 490 million cubic meters per annum, but in total in Lesotho, we'll be getting 1.227 billion cubic meters per annum. But the system is designed well. Remember, this system of Gauteng is designed that you can get water from KwaZulu-Natal. There is this dam there, your Woodstock and the Sterkfontein, then there are systems that are coming from Mpumalanga. It's getting more water from different systems, 14 systems. That's why there's no crisis. But the crisis is a behavior on how we actually manage our water system that we must improve. But also the idea now of trying to do water reuse and reclamation, there's too much effluent that goes into the river that we must treat into a good quality so that at least we don't just release water like we are doing, including the mine water that we must use in the Van Wassers Rand region to improve the yield of our system, Jeremy.
David Mahlobo, thank you very much indeed. You're the Deputy Minister of Water and Sanitation. I appreciate your time.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, a rare piece of good news for us hard-pressed consumers. South Africa's food and non-alcoholic beverage inflation falling to just 0.9% in July. If I've read this correctly, it's its lowest level in more than 16 years. That's helped pull headline inflation down to 4.3%. The biggest relief, as I understand it, coming from staples, maize meal, bread, meat, although not everything in the shopping basket is getting cheaper. So it raises the question, I think, is this a genuine turning point for household food costs or simply a flattering monthly number? Patrick Kelly is Chief Director for Price Statistics at Stats SA. Patrick, welcome back to the program. So are we genuinely paying less for food, or prices, are they simply rising a little more slowly?
Yeah, they're rising a little bit more slowly, Jeremy. Thanks for having us on. So the 0.9% year-on-year increase for food and non-alcoholic beverages is very low by historic terms, but is still an increase. If we delve down into that a little bit more deeply, we are actually having price drops in cereal products, and that is your staples that you've mentioned. That's down at negative 2% year-on-year. And that was even lower than the previous month's negative 1.5%. So you know, there are real drops in prices. For example, maize meal just between June and July dropped by 3.1%. The pasta products dropped, white bread by negative 0.6%. So, you know, that is quite encouraging. I think the other factor that's really helped with food inflation is really slowing meat inflation. You'd remember that, you know, a number of months ago we were suffering from the impact of the foot and mouth disease, which pushed beef prices up significantly. We've now come to a point where we actually have negative year-on-year rates of growth for beef products. So, for example, negative 8% for string beef, as an example.
So let me pick you up on a couple of issues. Let's stay with meat if we can. So if inflation dropping to 1.5% in a single month. Patrick, is that a sustainable shift or is it a statistical volatility? And while we're talking about meat, processed meat is still rising strongly, which obviously means the experience and the till will vary enormously depending on what we buy, right?
Yeah, that's true. Look, I mean, with inflation, no trend is forever. You know, it's until something changes out there that then has an impact. So I think that, I mean, if we just talk about the trend more generally, you know, these levels do seem quite low. There are specific factors that have driven them. I think the risk factor on food inflation is summer rains. Climatologists are telling us that we'll be in an El Nino phase, which means we'll have much less rain. How much less, I think, will have an impact on food prices. But going back to the meat, certainly, it's not all rosy. It's not just the beef products in deflation. But as you point out, processed meat products such as corned meat, you know, burger patties, etc., sausages, are all experiencing fairly high levels of inflation. So, for example, 12% for corned meat, 6.2% for sausages. So, you know, there's definitely a mix. If we look at the other unprocessed meat products, such as pork and lamb, those are also at much higher levels than the beef is at the moment.
What does your modeling say going forward about El Nino? How worried should consumers be?
Yeah, we don't really do any modeling per se. We just kind of measure the prices in the month that we're looking at. But I think that historically, El Nino does always have an impact. And generally, the harvest is a big determinant of food prices. So we were fortunate this last year that harvests were good, and that has helped then with the reduction in cereal price inflation. But certainly if there's a significant drought, that will have an impact. It could then be that we have to, for example, start buying maize on the international market. That would have an impact. So I do think it's something that we really have to keep our eyes wide open about.
For lower income households, I think it's fair to say that food takes up a much bigger share of spending. Does the national CPI risk understating the inflation pressure that people within that band are actually experiencing?
Well, actually, if you look at it, because food inflation is quite low, the poorer communities are actually experiencing lower inflation. So we do actually publish inflation rates for what we call decile, so basically dividing the population into 10 groups based on their income. And in July, the poorest group had inflation of 2.9%, the richest 4.6%. That's really a factor of low food inflation, high fuel inflation, you know, and the different spending patterns of those groups. So, you know, we do measure a wide range. We have almost 400 products in the basket that would cover items that are definitely purchased by lower income households, but obviously also those by those that are more affluent.
And Patrick, obviously an important distinction between lower inflation and lower prices. We've seen several years of sharp increases. Are you able to tell me how far above pre-inflation shock levels food prices remain?
No, not really. I mean, I think if we go back to the slowing inflation, it's a bit like you're driving your car at 80 kilometers an hour. That was our 5% last month. We now put on the brakes a bit and we're now driving at 60 kilometers. That's kind of our 4.3%. And you know, I think similarly with food. So we're going forward, prices are still increasing, but at a very slow pace.
And just a final question, you've referenced El Nino, but how quickly could this improvement reverse if we have more pressure on fuel prices?
An interesting thing we've been looking at, so I mean, obviously fuel itself has experienced very high levels of inflation, and you know, we're currently at 20% year on year. We did have a bit of a drop down in fuel in July, but I think that may go up as we go through the year. We've seen a knock-on effect onto public transport with the fuel price impact, but I don't think we're seeing yet an impact on other products. Now, fuel obviously is a transport aspect. The goods have to be transported around, but also oil feeds into fertilizer. And I guess if oil prices remain elevated, that could impact then on planting seasons and the like, and yields, and that could also have some pressure then on food prices.
Patrick Kelly is Chief Director for Price Statistics at Stats SA. Patrick, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
This interview is brought to you by the City of Cape Town. Now, I think it's fair to say that Cape Town, like many other centres, does have a housing problem, but the city says government cannot build its way out of it alone. It's now making a more direct pitch to developers, to banks and investors, to help turn city-owned land into affordable housing at scale. Through its Housing Investment Connect, the city says it can de-risk land, lower development barriers, and use public investment to make projects more attractive to private capital. I'm going to talk now to Carl Popheim, who is the City of Cape Town's Mayoral Committee Member for Human Settlements. Carl, welcome to you. Let's get straight to it. Why should private investors put their money into affordable housing in the city?
Well, thanks so much, Jeremy, and that's an important question. The reality is that over the last 5 years, the City of Cape Town administration has done more than in the preceding 15 years to accelerate access to affordable housing. You've mentioned some of it, but it's quite important, making sure we take to market and package de-risked, ready-to-develop parcels of well-located land in order to make sure we not only redress apartheid spatial planning, but grow the Cape Town economy. And so we've released, since the inception of the Mayoral Priority Program, just over 7 billion rands worth of city-owned land to the market, equating to a conservative 24,000 housing opportunities. Of those, 9,000 are currently on its way to council, 4,000 are ready to be developed. And so the opportunity is great, not just for us to have a social impact on Cape Town residents, but for developers and financiers to come and invest within this program. We believe that, yes, it's profitable, but more important, it's going to make sure that Cape Town benefits at the end of the day.
Let me push you a little bit on de-risking city-owned land. Carl, what risk is the city actually taking off the shoulders of developers?
Absolutely. So all the processes around land use that are required for developments in terms of the zoning, etc., making sure that the viability of the property is studied, making sure that we take away any of the approvals required at environmental level, all of that is done before we take the site to market. And essentially what a developer simply needs to do is create a site development plan and submit building plans. And I think that takes at least 24 months out of a development period, and significant cost to professional service providers, cost that we've borne on ourselves as the city through a dedicated affordable housing unit in the administration.
And Carl, tell me, how much land are we actually talking about here? And is there a genuine investment pipeline ready to go, or are you still trying to establish investor appetite?
No, well, I was so proud of the Housing Investment Connect that we're hosting. We were able to attract 10 billion rand in capital within that venue, within that engagement. FNB already coming to the party to say that we are able to commit 4 billion rand. And so we are finalizing negotiations to take that pledge to our pipeline and to our developers that have already been awarded. And so I'm quite proud of that. More importantly, as I've said earlier, that our pipeline consists of 4,500 units that are already in the market, ready to develop, but a further 17,000 that are on its way to council for approval. And so we are quite adamant that we cannot wait for national government or any other entity to come to the party with subsidies. And so in our innovative approach that we've undertaken with releasing our land at 90% discount, quite a critical point as well in terms of making sure there's financial viability, we are now saying, how do we mitigate the risk of not getting subsidies or getting it on time, but bringing capital to this attractive program.
Carl, I think it would be useful to define the word affordable, because it's a term, and you'll agree with me, that gets used very loosely sometimes. Affordable to whom and at what monthly income? Have you worked out those numbers?
No, absolutely. And I think particularly in the space where there's so many different government subsidized housing programs, there's a bit of confusion around what is an affordable housing development. And so quite simply, Jeremy, we've defined affordable housing as accessibility for individuals, particularly in Cape Town, earning a monthly income anywhere between 1,800 and 3,000-4,000 rand. And so that allows us to scale rentals within these developments, typically at about a third of your monthly income. So in our affordable housing developments, we anticipate rentals up to 10,500 and below. And so that obviously considers Cape Town as a whole, next to other metros in South Africa, our existing economy, our existing affordability, as well as our employment figures. And so that's currently the model that the city of Cape Town works on.
Carl, you'll agree with me that private investors need a return. The public wants cheaper housing. As I talk to you, I wonder to myself if those two objectives are not fundamentally in tension.
As a city, we've shown that while it's difficult within the country, historically it hasn't been successfully achieved, it actually is possible. It requires a metropolitan government to be intentional about what it wants to achieve. It requires a metropolitan government to be thoughtful about committing resources and human capital to achieving it. And so through one, the policy approval of council to discount land up to 90%, state-owned, municipal-owned land. Two, putting together a team of officials that can be dedicated to the de-risking of these sites to make it easier to develop, to make it cheaper to develop. But more importantly, thirdly, allocating our existing budget and grant funding to assist with bulk infrastructure, to assist with the development of social amenities. That has certainly made sure that developers can profit from investing within our program, but most importantly, the moral obligation of our city can be achieved to ensure access to affordable housing while growing the economy and getting jobs in every home within our city.
Carl Popheim is the City of Cape Town's Mayoral Committee Member for Human Settlements, and this interview was brought to you by the City of Cape Town. And that is our program for today. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.